We know Bates has some kind of hidden redoubt of his own somewhere. He trafficked extensively in government contracts, both open and covert, in the years leading up to the Newcost. The United States government, in turn, had substantial involvement in just the area of South America in which the mysterious outbreak is taking place, under the rubric of its failed war on drugs. Which, it appears from my readings in the archives, was concerned rather more urgently with manipulating the flow of recreational pharmaceuticals into the then U.S. for the profit of well-placed political interests than in suppressing the trade.
Major Mike took his unlit cigar stub from his mouth and studied it.
Figures. While it's tempting in hindsight to convict Bates of any and all dirty dealing, up to and including the Lindbergh kidnapping and the killing of Cock Robin, I'm not sure I see any kind of unbreakable evidentiary chain here.
Because there is not one, Lieutenant Commander. We are doing what is technically referred to as grasping at straws. Do you wish to participate?
You'll be sorry.
We're already sorry. What's the scam?
We transport you to South America to help organize the human residents of the area to resist the outbreak. At the same time, you can investigate whether the outbreak indicates Bates' secret base lies nearby and attempt to track it.
A bug hunt? Oh, I don't know. Might be a relief to rumble with somebody who can't shoot back.
Be careful what conclusions you leap to, Kane. These life forms are unlikely to be like anything known or even suggested in the literature of cryptozoology before the Newcost.
Crypto what? Baptiste, are you talking dirty?
Means the study of hidden animals. What that means is research into critters unrecognized by science, ranging from the okapi to the Loch Ness Monster.
The logical inference, and I might say the necessary one, is that the creatures are either alien life forms or genetically engineered ones, about which we know nothing for certain, except they are alien to us and unquestionably hostile. So how confident are you, Kane, that some of the life forms have not evolved or been designed to employ some sort of ranged attack?
Never argue with Baptiste. If you learn nothing else here in Cerberus, learn that.
Robeson leaned forward, resting his forearms on his knees with his big, powerful hands dangling between.
Do we need to go off for a private confab here, provided our hosts will be so kind?
Make yourselves at home, my friends.
Joe Weaver, who had sat upright throughout the discussion, slid down in his chair and rested one Popeye forearm on the back of the vacant chair next to his.
I don't see the need. It's a pretty thin lead to Bates, but it's a lot thicker than anything we've been able to turn up to date. We're just spinning our wheels up here. I want something to do, even if we don't wind up with Gil Bates with a noose around his neck.
I'm with you.
I could use a change of scenery.
Lock and load. Reichert looked intently at Bridget, causing Domi to scowl.
Will you be accompanying us, Dr. Baptiste?
I'm not really a doctor.
Certainly your quite intensive training and experience as senior archivist in Koboldville would serve as at least the equivalent of a pre-Skydark PhD. To be truthful, though, gentlemen, I have not decided precisely what allocation of resources would be optimal.
Grant shifted in his seat and fixed Lakesh with a glare like that of a Kodiak bear awakened from a much-needed sleep.
Are you forgetting that you don't run jack around here, Lakesh? We're all volunteers in this chicken shit outfit.
Ah. Forgive me if, in my quite wholly understandable enthusiasm, I misspoke, friend Grant. However, I am generally conceded the role of coordinator and chief strategist. Or do you desire a realignment of functions here in the redoubt?
No, not really. I just don't want you getting the notion you can just dictate to the rest of us, is all.
Admit it, Grant. He's got us by the short and curlies. Neither of us wants the job of running the damn show. And if he really wants to go totally nuke on us, he can always threaten to appoint that shit-heel Philboyd his successor and pack it in.
The door to the operations center opened. A slight, short woman with short gray-blonde hair and big glasses walked in with a worried expression on her face. Kane understood that was her standard look, but it was more pronounced than usual. Her name was Sally, and she was an analytical whiz Kane and Grant had helped to escape from Snakefishville sometime before.
How may we help you, Sally?
Our computer projections have come back.
And what do they have to tell us?
No good news, I'm afraid, Dr. Lakesh. remote observation suggests that not only alien flora and fauna appear to be involved in the expanding biological anomaly, the speed and completeness of the replacement of the existing ecosystem appear to indicate that microorganisms are involved as well.
Good news is everywhere.
Sally looked at Reichert, blinked several times rapidly, and then turned back to Lakesh as if shutting the boisterous young man out of her consciousness, possibly forever.
Go on, Sally. What do these new data mean?
If correct, this means that the invasion cannot be stopped by any conventional means.
Excuse me, Ms.
Her eyes, gray and huge behind her circular glasses, flicked to Lakesh as if seeking permission to address the outsider. Lakesh nodded.
Right. Sally Wright.
Ms. Wright, could I ask you what you meant by conventional means?
Guns, fire, explosives, that sort of thing. Fire and explosives might work on a purely local basis. That would be all, though.
How about poison?
That could cause substantial environmental damage.
Doesn't whatever is happening down there already constitute substantial environmental destruction? Inasmuch as it's supplanting the extant ecosystem?
Oh, it is. Altogether. But I was concerned about damage to areas not yet affected by the invading bioforms. In any event, our best assessment is that poisons would not work either. For one thing, the bloom is so large already that dispersing them as widely as necessary, yet in effective concentrations, would be quite beyond our means, even if we possessed or could manufacture sufficient quantities of toxins.
Provided we even knew what killed them.
Precisely.
All right, Sally. You sounded like there was a but in that first statement of yours. Do you have some idea what unconventional means might do the trick?
Yes, I do. But I don't think you're going to like it, Dr. Lakesh.
Grant sat in the shelter of an outcrop, cradling a G3 battle rifle with starlight scope. Kane was lying on his belly in the scrub in the dark. The full moon laughed down from a vast idiot face.
Couldn't we have jumped straight inside?
That depends on whether you're just tired of the world or of life.
He just got tired of his job and ran off to join the circus. Ask Bates's goons how ready Kane was to lie down and wait for dirt to start hitting him in the eyes.
You're a hell of a one to talk about running off to join the circus. Who is it who's constantly threatening to run off to the islands and play co-shogun with Shizuka?
At least there is Shizuka, unless you've struck up a friendship with a female mountain goat.
I'm sure you gentlemen are deriving great satisfaction from your primitive bonding ritual.
Kane pressed the mini-binos to his eye.
I still don't see why we're doing this the old-fashioned way. Why not jump in?
I thought Lakesh explained it in sufficient detail.
Oh, him. We've been tuning him out for days.
And days it had been. While Team Phoenix was off playing Hearts and Minds in South America, Kane and Grant cooled their heels and grew increasingly restive as Brigid, Sally Wright, and Lakesh poured through what seemed like every byte of data accumulated in the vast Cerberus database. Occasionally, they had made brief jumps into assorted hellholes, seeking new puzzle pieces. Grant still favored his right leg after the last jump, and Kane wouldn't be eating any fish for a while, at least until certain memories lost their immediacy. But at last, Lakesh claimed a breakthrough. Not the location of the deadly grail they sought, but perhaps the map to where it lay hidden. And it led them here. Back, as it were, to the source. In front of them, the Cobaltville administration monolith rose like a white porcelain dildo gleaming in the light of a gibbous moon.
We're not sure who is presently in charge of Cobaltville. To jump directly in could bring the whole place down on our necks.
That's enough for me. We've done this stuff before. This is nothing special, just another job. What worries me is getting out.
Tell me again just why it is we want this end of the world bug anyway.
You heard those briefings as well as I did, Kane, even if I was the only one paying attention. The eruption in South America itself has the potential to destroy the world. It will take extraordinary means to defeat it.
I mean, using a thing like that could destroy the world in order to save it. Maybe it's just me, but that seems more than a bit ass backward.
Lakesh believes that he has the capability of altering the self-replicating assembler in such a way that it will attack organisms possessing the gene sequences peculiar to the invader ecosystem, and only such organisms.
That's reassuring. You know, this wouldn't be the first time Lakesh has overestimated himself.
But it sure could be the last.
Brigid shook her head. In the moonlight, the glory of her fire-gold hair was muted to shades of gray, like the rest of the nighttime world.
You shouldn't malign Lakesh. He's made mistakes, but he does have a great intellect.
Which he's used to put your nicely turned ass in harm's way about as often as Grant's and mine, Baptiste. But more to the point, if he outsmarts himself this time, zingo. No more world from magma skyward with, what, 72 hours, according to Mustang Sally's little horror show?
There'd still be a world, Kane. It'd just be a layer of gray goo 20 clicks thick or whatever.
And the real pisser is, it probably wouldn't zero out our new Anunnaki pals, although it wouldn't leave them much to lord it over.
This is our best chance.
Don't forget, nobody we know of has so much as seen one of these damn things firsthand and lived. We don't even have a tissue sample for Lakesh to match.
Gathering samples is a primary part of Team Phoenix's mission in the Upper Amazon.
Better them than us.
How do you figure we get in, Kane?
I'm all over it, like stink on a swampy.
No idea, huh?
None whatever.
Kane picked himself up from the sandy soil of the ridgetop.
Might as well head in. We want to be dressed out and waiting patiently in line at dawn when the gates open.
The others stood, hefting light rucksacks.
Baptiste?
What is it, Kane?
Can it really do that? I mean, turn the surface of the Earth and everything on it into muck in a couple of days?
Theoretically, yes.
Then we got nothing to worry about. We all know theory never pans out in the real world.
Dream on, Kane. Theory only chooses not to work when it's on our side.
Yeah, you're right. Well, follow me, people. Time to break back into jail.
Domi walked through the forest at the head of the small but well-armed group. She slapped at her paper-white forearm. When her hand came away, a scarlet smear was left behind.
Hell damn, I hate bugs. Except the juicy ones.
You know, I hate to bring this up, but aren't you a little, underdressed for the occasion?
The slight albino woman stopped and turned back.
Why do you say that?
They stopped and stared at her, their faces dappled with forest leaf shadows beneath the brims of their jungle camo boonie hats. The hats were made of the same stuff as their camo suits, with extra Kevlar lining to stiffen them and provide resistance to impact. Domi wore a gray, green-black camo patterned t-shirt that left her arms bare, as were her slim, strong legs.
Wear a long-sleeve shirt.
Point is, it's not cold.
Well, bugs for one. Less likely to bite if you covered up more.
If I get big enough bugs, hey, it's protein.
She gestured at the four men of Team Phoenix. Beneath a heavy burden of weapons and gear, inevitable given how far they were from the caches Gil Bates had salted across North America for them in happier times, all wore camouflage battle dress with long sleeves and full legs on the trousers. It was less hot and humid than they had expected. They were fairly high up here, not far east of the Great Wall of the Andes, but their faces still shone with sweat from exertion.
Is it really worth stumbling around in your own personal saunas to avoid a few bug bites, big, brave men?
Mike Hayes took the stub of unlit cigar from his mouth.
You know, hon, if you weren't so darn easy on the eyes, a man might be tempted to ask just what you're tagging along here for.
Tagging along? Who's in the lead here, old man?
The old men are keeping up with you pretty well.
For his main weapon, Reichert carried a 5.56mm Kalashnikov AK-108, part of a special lot assembled by Joe Weaver from the pick of the parts in the bins of the Izhmash factory in the USSR. Although its connection to classic Kalashnikovs was largely cosmetic, it had a similar distinctive profile, being built on a Kalashnikov frame, but the action was all new. It was accurate, smooth in operation, and utterly reliable. It was also heavy, as the young Delta operator was noticing.
Not that we don't enjoy following you, but what exactly are you doing still with us? We could be in Indian country here.
Domi had accepted Lakesh's request that she squire the team to a geomagnetic node in the upper Amazon with an interphaser, the distinctive pyramidion of which jutted at an angle from her backpack. Though none of Team Phoenix had heard her explicitly instructed to do so, they had all just assumed she'd bounce back to the climate-controlled confines of Cerberus as soon as she dropped off her delivery. Then again, despite the brevity of their acquaintance with the Gammon albino, the four men all understood she wouldn't exactly feel slavishly bound by instructions, no matter who issued them.
You think I'm afraid? I'm used to Indians. I helped you get through Skydog and his bunch.
We'd rather you not remind us, given how we kind of killed some of them before we found out that we were all on the same side, more or less.
Upon being revived from cold storage, the men of Team Phoenix had been directed by a holographic projection of their employer, supposedly recorded before his death shortly after the big nuke, to save the shattered America from the threat of enslavement by the Barons and their allies in Cerberus Redoubt. He claimed to have foreseen it all using his special predictive computer programs. Since his company had made him fabulously rich by being the number one supplier of software to the darker agencies of the U.S. government, there had seemed nothing intrinsically implausible about it, much as it went against each man's strongly held notions of free will. So they had made their way toward Cerberus Redoubt with the single-minded determination of men with nothing to live for and nothing more to lose, men who had not known, because how could they have known, what it truly meant to shed their time and everything familiar, like a snake its skin. All had lost whatever family they had to various tragedies before being recruited by Bates. Now, chronically marooned, they had literally nothing to live for but the mission. And if they died trying, who was left to miss them? Their path led them right through land claimed by Skydog and his Lakota band, a bunch known for giving warm welcome to trespassers. Domi, who by that time had fallen in with the team, tried unsuccessfully to dissuade them. Fanatically determined, the team had blasted its way right through the heart of the Lakota Nation, as well as Kane and Grant, before attaining their goal, only to learn that everything told them was a lie. The people of Cerberus Redoubt, including Director Dr. Singh, painted by Gilgamesh Bates as arch menace and the man who would be king of America, if not the world, were actually fighting to end the Baron's ruthless domination, not perpetuate it. And Bates himself, far from dying of cancer in some bunker during Skydark a few years after the war, was alive and lamentably well, a Freezy himself. In fact, Gil Bates was the man with the plan for world domination. And the secret of control over the Mattrans network held within Cerberus was to be his key. Confronted with the brutal realization that they had been used, they swore to avenge themselves on Bates. Except, they had no idea where to find him.
What my associates are trying to say in their ingenuous, tongue-tied way, seeing as how they're far less used to the company of beautiful women than I am, is that we wonder why you're choosing to stay with us on the ground when we face danger from the bioforms, as well as possibly unfriendly locals.
Been in danger before, once or twice. Didn't kill me.
There's always that first time.
Different danger. Spicy.
Larry Robison blinked and pulled his head back on his powerful neck as something like an insect zipped past his face to light on the bole of a tree at face level. He reached out with big blunt fingers.
People don't use blowguns this high up in the Amazon basin, do they?
I don't think so. Well, they do now.
Robison plucked a small dart with a splint of green leaf from the trunk.
I suspect we found the locals. Or rather, they've found us.
The creature looked like a flying fox grafted to a giant scorpion. They could hear it clearly through the allegedly break-proof armaglass pane. Its black-tipped stinger struck the see-through synthetic repeatedly. The giant man with a great mane of reddish-black hair and dark reddish-purple skin drew back from the window in alarm.
Is it really wise, Gilgamesh, to release such horrors upon the world?
Don't talk about my creations like that. They are superior to you in every way.
His brow furrowed as he gazed mildly down upon Ishtar. She would have looked small next to a man of normal size. Beside him, she looked like a child.
They're not intelligent. No more intelligent than dogs.
That is one of many ways in which they are superior. They're untouched by the taint of rational thought.
A second man, red-bearded, his long ovine face dough-white, almost blue in the fluorescent lights of the subterranean lab, raised a hand. He was spectrally thin and enormously tall, yet the dark giant towered over him by a foot.
I can see many happy hours of debate in the offing. Might I suggest we defer the pleasure in the interests of tending to more urgent matters?
The giant wore a tunic of heavy twill in dark blue-gray, with large brass buttons, over gray trousers with dark red stripes. The dress uniform Gilgamesh Bates had mandated for his bodyguards, of which the huge man was commander. His big square jaw worked in evident dissatisfaction, but he didn't speak. The woman smiled with sweet malice. She tended toward gauntness, with narrow, sunken-cheeked features and eyes like mad blue stars. Her hair was scarlet and hacked off any which way. She was a rock star's daughter who had become one of the leading bioengineers of the last years before the nuke cost.
Besides, Enkidu, you've nothing to fear. The array of organisms I have created have been designed specifically as successors to the corrupt cancer cells. Humans and the poor creatures of Earth they have tormented, twisted, and tainted for so long. They will conquer the world for our master, and leave you nothing to do.
The man Gil Bates had christened Enkidu flared his nostrils. A corner of the broad, full-lipped mouth opened to expose big, flawless white teeth.
You'll save the world by destroying it?
Improbably, Enkidu had once been among the world's leading contract assassins. Then he had repented. Unfortunately, by that time, Gil Bates had found him and placed him, with his unbreakable code of honor, irremediably in his debt.
I'll save the world by destroying man.
Enkidu turned to his master, opening and closing his huge hands helplessly.
What is all this? Is this how you plan to save humanity from strife and misery?
It is a means to an end.
What end? The end of humankind? Don't tell me you buy into her bullshit. She's as much a monster as any of her pet horrors.
Ishtar herself took no affront at the giant's words. She tapped on the window and gazed lovingly at the winged, scorpion-tailed thing on the other side. Gilgamesh Bates extended a finger like a giant albino spider's leg and crooked it for his chief bodyguard to follow him out of the antechamber. At the doorway, Enkidu looked back over his shoulder. Ishtar had pressed herself up against the window and seemed to be writhing against it. One hand was pressed, fingers splayed, against the armaglass. The other disappeared somewhere in front of her hips. Shaking his head, Enkidu joined his master in the small office where Bates sat with his long legs folded, one knee over the other.
Those who oppress this world hold the upper hand, Enkidu. We are few. Too few, as you well know. Ishtar's creatures give us leverage.
Which we can use precisely how? Listen to the crazy bitch. She intends to wipe the world clean and start over.
Ishtar is a woman as troubled as she is talented. As for how we may use what I might term the very solid artifacts of her delusional system, that is a strategy issue, and all I am free to say is that I am on it.
What about the oppressors, then?
Oh, the next move is up to them. I will respond appropriately. Or, as required, you will. I have every faith in you, Enkidu.
He rose and patted the giant on a muscle-clotted arm.
When will you learn to have faith in me, my friend? Have I not brought us all safely through 2 centuries of unparalleled disaster? I may not know all, but I certainly know best.
I am sorry, Gil Bates. Sometimes I forget myself.
The incident is already forgotten. Come, let's get some tea.
Hola, amigos.
The painted man who stood up out of the underbrush or swung around the boles of trees to level lances and shotguns at Team Phoenix had light copper skin and were tall for South American Indians, although the tallest was still shorter than any of the North Americans. Most wore loincloths. Some had clean but ragged shirts. A few wore floppy hats, others turbans of bright cloth. They failed to respond to Reichert's greeting.
They might not speak English. Back before the nuke cost, lots of Indians in Latin America didn't. or wouldn't. Where's Domi?
Seems to have ducked out. Smart girl.
Hayes addressed the people, pointing guns at them.
Your move, people.
Americans?
You speak English?
Yes.
Slipping from the underbrush without making a sound, a woman stepped forward. She was clearly one with the rest. Slim, copper-skinned, dark, with heavy raven hair tied in a ponytail that hung well down her back. She was tall, like her exclusively masculine companions, taller than Larry Robeson would have expected. She was also intensely pretty in an exotic way. She wore an oversized man's olive drab shirt, possibly a uniform part, khaki shorts, low-topped hiking boots, and a straw hat that had probably once been white.
Are you a stupidos? Why have you not put down your weapons?
We didn't want to do anything without instructions. We'd like to avoid misunderstandings, if possible.
Put them down now, slowly. Do not misunderstand that if you wish a chance to live.
Given the choice between a chance to live and the alternative...
Belay the stand-up routine. Remember the old saw, dying is easy, comedy is hard.
Hayes unslung his chopped and channeled machine gun and stooped to ease it to the spongy ground. The others did likewise. The locals tracked their every move with their weapons.
Your packs and pistol belts as well. Now back away. Be very careful. My people have little reason to trust light-skinned strangers.
The team complied, then stood with hands vaguely in the air. Their captors didn't seem big on prisoner control techniques, such as having them lace fingers behind heads or making them lie spread eagle on their faces. Then again, with numbers, the drop, and a pretty good edge regarding knowledge of the local terrain, the Indians may not have seen the point in bothering with anything more elaborate. Several of the Indians quickly swooped down and scooped up the discarded weapons and packs. They kept their faces impassive as carved idle heads. The team members, three with military special ops experience, one with extensive local cultural knowledge, understood that, like a lot of tribal groups around the world, these people were very likely unwilling to display emotion of any kind before strangers. Mike Hayes squinted up at the sky. The sun was almost at its zenith.
They don't seem to be clued in to our communicators.
Both bone conduction speakers and microphones were tiny and flesh-colored, as were the wires running from them down the backs of the man's necks and down to the actual comm units secured in buttoned pockets. Even a cursory body search would turn them up, but their captors seemed disinclined to get too close to their outsized prisoners.
Great. We got them surrounded.
The woman, who appeared unarmed, stepped up to stand before the four, gazing up at them with fists on hips.
Very well. Now, who are you and who are you spying for?
We aren't spies. We're on a biological expedition, investigating what you might call an apparent outbreak of a plague.
Biology? Nobody does science anymore. It's something you read about in books, if you have and read books.
One of her men came up to show her Hayes' machine gun with the shortened barrel and the pistol foregrip attached to the gas tube. She frowned at it, reached out, just touched it, and then looked back at the team.
Why so many guns if you are biologists, especially studying microbes?
We aren't biologists, ma'am, and this plague isn't exactly microbes. At least, not all of them are. We're not exactly sure. Some of these organisms are pretty big, as large as a small dog, at least.
You call them a disease?
We call them a plague. They come in various sizes, and they destroy everything in their path. There are even alien growths that crowd out the local plants.
She stared at him a moment, face as hard as fired clay.
Do you think I am a child, Norte Americano? Even a child would laugh at such a story.
You wouldn't think it's all that funny when you meet these things. If we were going to tell you a lie to cover our real mission, don't you think we'd come up with something a bit more plausible?
Maybe not. You might just be stupid.
There's that.
Do you mind my asking just who you are?
These are my people. We fight for our freedom against oppressors from the West, criollos, European-descended ones. We are the Atshuara of the Shuara Nation. You may have heard of us. I am Consuelo.
Well, Consuelo, we brought some evidence we can show you to try to change your mind. It's all in our packs. If you give us a chance, we might be able to help you.
Might be better to go about it in a different setting, too.
The small guerrilla leader turned to her people. Several of them discussed the issue in whispers among themselves. They seemed disinterested. Robeson wasn't sure whether that was a promising sign or not. A decision apparently reached, Consuelo turned her fierce dark gaze on her captives. It hadn't changed. As far as Robeson could tell, she always looked fierce.
Very well. You will come with us to our camp. It lies no great distance away. And if you are lying, we can always kill you later.
They set out through the forest. The terrain was hilly. There were patches of dense brush interspersed with stands of tall trees. Team Phoenix ventured some sub-vocalization on their comm units.
So what's with this Achuara stuff? Our charming hostess sounded as if we ought to recognize it.
It did sound familiar now that you mention it. I can't quite place it, though. Just on the tip of my tongue. I can tell you what it means. The Spanish speakers, the one they call Criollos, call them Jivaros.
They topped a rise. In the little clear draw before them nestled a dozen small hooches, some with rude plank walls, others wattle and daub. Most had palm thatch roofs. From a palm tree at the right and higher end of the ville dangled half a dozen wrinkled objects the approximate size and shape of withered grapefruit.
Jivaros? Holy shit, I've heard of them. But aren't they...
Headhunters.
Bridget Baptiste stood in malodorous shadow with her back pressed to a warehouse wall altogether typical of the Cobaltville Tartarus pits. Chipped and nasty. From out on the street beyond her wafted the typical Tartarus morning aromas, spice and decay and despair. Bridget had a mass of black hair with a distinct undertone of copper, bright metallic, visible when the light struck it. A legacy of the leather soldiers, Indian mercenaries brought north with their families by 16th century Spanish colonizers to guard their remote territories from the likes of Kiowa, Comanche, and Apache raiders. The leather soldiers were Tlaxcaltecan Indians of the Valley of Mexico, whose characteristic striking red copper hair predated the Europeans' arrival. The woman was tall and exceedingly well-built, with dark eyes and cinnamon skin. She would have been strikingly beautiful but for a port wine birthmark that covered the upper right quadrant of her face like a bizarre carnival mask. It drew the eye irresistibly. Grant stood beside her with his arms folded across his broad chest. He wore faded khaki trousers and a vest with many pockets, big boots, a loose white linen shirt with long sleeves. A rag, once camo pattern and now itself faded to the hue of dust, was wrapped around his head. A long, thick braid of black hair hung over one shoulder like a hawser. Goggles hid his eyes.
This is a lousy idea, an all-time worst.
Which part?
The man peering around the end of the wall was an albino, with a big floppy hat to shield his chalk-cheeked, white-bearded face from the dangerously intense rays of the Rocky Mountain sun, and the collar of his flannel shirt was turned up to guard his pallid neck. His eyes were rubies.
Entering a pit full of pissed-off scorpions? Cobaltville's three all-time most wanted fugitives returning to the scene of their many crimes? Or the mission that brought us here in the first place?
Yes.
Think about this. The very unlikelihood of our coming back to Cobaltville at all, much less walking bolt upright through the main gates in the full light of day, is our best possible disguise.
Classic point man logic. Ballsy, yet stupid.
I didn't hear your brilliant alternative plan, Mr. Experiments.
Will you two quit striking attitudes and pipe down before someone hears us?
You sure this is the right place, Baptiste?
Bridget shot him a narrow-eyed glare. The chocolate-brown contacts might have hidden the laser-intense emerald green of her eyes, but did nothing to lessen their death-beam impact.
I saw the maps, so that settles it.
Bridget had an eidetic memory. Working in concert with Sally Wright, who originated from Snakefishville's historical division, Bridget had turned up blueprints among the files looted by Lakesh over time from Cobaltville's own data storage. Among them, she had found a means to infiltrate the all-important administrative monolith. When they had escaped from Cobaltville several years before, Kane and Bridget, in particular, had availed themselves of an unauthorized connection between the pits and the bottom-level maintenance shops. It was no great stretch to presume that in the wake of their escape, it had been found and neutralized. It was also no great stretch to suppose that human nature being what it was, some alternate means had been found of effecting illicit traffic between those below and those above. While Lakesh still maintained lines of information into the Vills, he also stayed cagey about what they were. In any event, his contacts were unlikely to provide information about officially unknown illicit access routes. So the three were going to make a new one.
Okay, here we go.
They slipped around to the rear of the warehouse. An alley about 2 yards across ran between it and the wall of the base of the monolith itself. A bunch of piled crates and sodden cardboard boxes clotted the alley.
According to the architectural drawings, the wall is especially thin here. On the other side is a storeroom, and beyond that, a parking area for low-priority vehicles awaiting repair.
You sure about that?
The glare in Bridget's eyes showed she knew Kane was baiting her, but she answered anyway.
I am sure of the information contained in the database. Whatever changes have taken place recently, it seems unlikely any major structural alterations may be among them. As for what we may find on the other side, if you want certainty, Kane, all I have to offer is this. One day, we will all die.
And maybe it doesn't take even then.
She touched herself reflexively at her breastbone. In the mind and soul-wrenching throes of jump nightmares, they had been shown visions of being Anamkara's soul friends, and that their destinies were intertwined through many past lives and presumably future ones as well.
Let's get this over with. Discipline's gone to hell in the Ville, but somebody's going to stumble on us if we stand here all morning, running our heads.
Grant shucked his shabby backpack, rooted around in it, came up with something that resembled part of an undersized folding chair, just two sticks of well-weathered wood pinned together at the centers. He strode up to the concrete inner wall.
This the place?
Yes, that's right.
Grant opened the sticks into an X. Digging with a thumbnail, he brought up the end of a strip of tape along one side of both sticks, stained to match the sticks themselves, and peeled it down. It revealed a sticky surface, by which he stuck the X onto the weak spot in the wall as indicated by Bridget. Finally, he took an initiator from a pocket of his vest, keyed it alive, and stuck it to the junction of the X, which was cast of plastic explosive tinted to resemble wood. Bridget tensed. Then she grabbed Kane, who squatted beside her on his heels like an obedient servant. She hauled him upright, slammed his back to the wall, and pinned him there with an impassioned lip lock. Consuela's face was hard as a carved wooden mask when she looked away from the projected images dancing on the lumpy mud stucco wall of the darkened hut.
I don't believe it.
Oh, for crying out.
Mike Hayes raised a hand to quell Reichert's frustration.
Por qué?
Consuelo turned her head quickly to look at him, her mouth like a trapdoor. She seemed to be personally offended that such a typical-looking gringo should speak Spanish as well as he did.
It is absurd. You show me monster movies and expect me to be scared.
They scared the hell out of me, lady. What can we do to convince you they're real?
We are the Achuara. We know all the creatures in the forest, all the plants. We have seen nothing like what you show.
That's the point. What killed our friends was, in effect, an alien invasion.
Aliens from outer space, perhaps?
Not necessarily. We suspect they're products of genetic manipulation, like the mutants that appeared after the big war.
Those were products of radiation. No powerful pockets of radiation remain these far upriver. There were never many. Thus, I know there can be no mutations.
The team exchanged frustrated looks in the semi-dark. They still had not been body-searched. Each had any number of useful goodies hidden on his person. Breaking out of the hut, with its single guard outside the door armed with an AK-47, would have presented small difficulty, even had they been stripped buck naked. But neither their concealed toys, nor all their lethal resourcefulness, suggested a way they could escape through territory as utterly unknown to them as it was utterly familiar to their captors. For the moment, they had nowhere to go. More to the point, they needed to talk to these people to convince them of the awful danger they faced. So they would stay until a better alternative presented itself, or until their captors, who seemed mostly puzzled by them, decided to try something more draconian than mere enforced hospitality.
Haven't you heard reports of unknown creatures and plant life? Haven't your people reported anything strange?
All the time. The woods are strange. My people are accustomed to viewing and speaking with spirits, but no strange animals or plants.
What motive would we have for lying to you about this?
She put her hands on her hips and stared at them for a moment. In the yellow light of the hurricane lamp, with her hair unbound and gleaming, she looked almost like a pretty child, except for the hard lines at her eyes and mouth.
Bearded, white-skinned foreigners have always found reasons of their own to lie to our people. You might be emissaries of the one who claims to liberate us at the point of guns.
Who's that?
If you truly do not know, perhaps you have fallen from the sky, as you said. We know such things happened once. Perhaps they still do. Perhaps I should listen to those of my people who say we should torture you until you speak the truth.
Trouble with torture is that it doesn't get you the truth so much as what your subject thinks you want to hear.
So I have heard. Since you seem truly not to know, I shall tell you. We fight the encroachment of the Criollos, as I have said. The forces of the Republic of Marañón, the Liberation Army, they call themselves. But they are really conquerors.
Are those their heads hung on that tree out there?
Jesus, ixnay on the unken shre edze. Why are you speaking pig Latin? She can't hear us.
General principles.
Quit obsessing on the shrunken heads. We're at war!
Sorry. Culture shock. Forget I said anything.
Now I will sleep. In the morning, perhaps you will either have come up with a more persuasive argument or have decided to tell me the truth.
She turned and went out. The heavy wooden door was barred from outside. Reichert slumped down on a sway-backed bench of rotting wood with his back to the wall.
Tough house. Why does she call herself Consuelo anyway? I don't know much Spanish. But the one thing I thought I did know was that women's names end in A.
It's a noun.
Joe Weaver lay on his back on a reed mat spread on the trodden earthen floor, with his head resting on a roll of cloth.
It means consolation.
It's like chupacabras.
What is? Consuelo? She's got a tough streak, but how the hell does that make her a chupacabras?
The word. It has a feminine plural ending, but it's a masculine and singular to boot. It means one who sucks goats. So El Chupacabras is correct, even though it sounds as if it shouldn't be.
I worry about you sometimes. You just aren't right.
Kane put his left arm to the warehouse wall and slipped his right behind Bridget's back. He kissed her back, hard. Her big, faux brown eyes went wide. She rolled them to her right toward the other end of the warehouse from the monolith wall. A pair of mags strolled into view. They wore long black mag coats of cloth-covered Kevlar over black field uniforms, the usual patrol garb, not the full-body polycarbonate hard-contact armor. They stopped and stared. The one on the left had dark brown hair with a cowlick, a busted-up nose, and hairy ears that stuck way out to the sides of his wide head. He was short and wide.
Well, what do we got here?
His partner had a narrow head, pink splotched skin with orange freckles, button nose, long upper lip, and a slash mouth. His head was shaved. His hair would surely be red. He smiled a gap-toothed smile.
She don't look too dirty, Malcord. Let's put this taint in the dirt where he belongs and tear us off a piece for ourselves.
That's just not a professional attitude to take, Wenderoth. So you got to go second.
Wenderoth laid a big hand, furred all over the back with orange like an orangutan's, on Kane's shoulder.
Peel yourself off the soft goods, Whitey. Stand easy, and we won't bust you up too bad.
Kane's face turned to his, the pale lips peeled back in a wild smile, mirrored in the madness of his eyes. All the pink ran out the bottom of Wenderoth's ugly, long face.
You're no roamer! You're...
A 10-inch double-edged knife was suddenly punched through his throat from left to right, just behind his Adam's apple. Approaching Bridget to claim his turn, Malcorn saw what had happened and stopped as if his feet had been nailed to the planet.
You killed a mag!
Kane ripped out his blade sideways in a gusher of red blood.
Nah, he was never a real mag. He was just a scumbag shakedown artist. Now he's dead, and you're next, Malcorn, you pathetic mega dick.
Kane?
Malcorn brought up his right arm to let his power holster slam his sin eater into his hand from its concealment in his coat's voluminous tearaway sleeve. Bridget dropped to her side on the littered ground, hauled her skirt-covered knees up to her chin, and kicked his legs sideways right out from under him. As Malcorn fell, he formed his hand into a half-fist, initiating the power holster. The big handgun slammed free of his coat sleeve. Kane's hand intercepted it before it reached its destination.
No guns. Noisy.
The machine pistol was a badge of more than manhood to any mag. Along with the insignia of the Magistrate Division itself, Crimson Scales of Justice against a nine-spoked wheel, it set its bearer apart from the rest of humanity, even the elite few specialists who lived in the enclaves. The Sin Eater was the prime instrument for keeping the scum at bay, an important consideration here in the Tartarus pits where scum abounded. Malcorn succeeded in knocking the weapon spinning down the alley toward the exposed Monolith Foundation. He headbutted Kane on the nose, causing red sparks to dance behind Kane's eyes. Then, tearing loose, he darted past his foe in single-minded pursuit of his sidearm. Grant came around the corner with his phony cue dangling down the left side of his chest.
What the hell's going on?
He saw the squat magistrate scrambling toward him on all fours. Then, his eye was caught by the Sin Eater spinning through the grit on the ground.
No shooting!
Grant raised his right foot out before him and heel-kicked the weapon behind him.
Aw, shit!
As Grant neared Malcorn, the mag dove, trying to shoot for Grant's legs and take him down. But Grant had mastered the brutally blunt and practical mag unarmed combative style long before he ever went off to study the more esoteric arts at Shizuka's court. Anticipating the takedown, he stepped forward and brought up his left knee sharply. It caught the charging mag as much in the chest as chin, sparing him a broken neck. The impact slammed him mostly upright. Grant gave him a forward elbow slam to the side of the head. Malcorn rocked back on the heels of his black boots, stunned. Grant grabbed him and ran him face first into the warehouse wall. Then he frog marched him around the corner, out of sight.
Where is he going?
Kane was grinning an abstracted half-grin. Grant nipped back briskly around the wall and set his back to it.
We caught a strike when that plucked ape Malcorn turned up like he did, for once. He served both to muffle the noise and help tamp the force of the blast. Only decent goddamn thing he ever did in his life.
And you say I'm a cold heart.
Grant stooped to retrieve Malcorn's Sin Eater. He tossed the weapon to Bridget, who caught it one-handed as if she did that every day of her life.
Here, cover us while we check whether we broke through or not.
You've come a long way from Senior Archivist.
Bridget popped the magazine out to make sure it was charged.
And now, I'm about to come full circle.
Two hours later, Larry Robeson awoke and began to sit up from the leaf pad bed their captors had provided. A hand clamped over his mouth, stopped him. He glared around, hand going for a cold steel lockback folding knife carried in a small pocket on his right thigh.
Easy.
Chagrined that an older man, not to mention a jarhead, had responded more quickly than he had, Robeson nodded to his boss to release him. Around him, the others were moving in darkness, alleviated only by greenish-silver moonlight streaming in through a window of the hooch. They quickly took stock of what the gorillas had left them. Riker checked the load on a .40-caliber baby Glock 27 holdout pistol he kept secreted in his battle dress. Hayes had his own backup piece, a .380 Walther PPK, in hand. He moved to put his back to the wall by the window. Weaver's sneaky pistol was a palm-sized black Kel-Tec P-32.
Who do you reckon these dudes are?
Who knows? Who cares?
We might. Depends whether they're more likely to torture and kill uninvited guests than our current hosts are.
The Navy boy's job is to talk them out of it.
Me?
We're down here to convince the Indiges to help us assess and deal with the threat.
He put his PPK away.
What are you doing? What are we gonna do?
Hayes unwrapped a fresh cigar.
What we came down here for. So, put them back in your pants, boys. We await events before we take any action.
Wait in here?
Unless you're eager to wander outside into the middle of a firefight in the dark between our captors and people we don't even know, yes.
Speaking of firefights, these walls aren't going to stop many bullets. That's at the door.
Robeson looked to Hayes. The heavyset leader stuck his cigar in his mouth.
Stand easy, but be ready to move.
The door was snatched open. A shadow figure stood there, diminutive and bandy-legged and pointing an AK-47, unmistakable despite the darkness. His posture showed he was tensing to shoot into the hooch. Team Phoenix grabbed for their own reconcealed weapons, knowing there was no time. There was a flicker of orange light. A shadow strobed across the floor of the hut. The gorilla fell into it and lay still. Hayes took the cigar out of his mouth.
That was a pretty damn sucky call on my part.
They crouched then, low to reduce exposure to stray bullets. Robeson felt a certain sick thrill, not at the danger, which was scarcely a novel element, if nothing to welcome or take lightly, but at the uncertainty. How to play this? With their backup weapons, which, in their highly trained hands, were far from inconsiderable, even matched against much more powerful weapons? Or, as Major Mike wanted them to, barehanded, trusting in reflexes or maybe just providence to keep them alive from one moment to the next as a battle raged right outside the hut's flimsy walls? Well, it's not as if we've got any place else to go just now. Robeson felt a drop of sweat run down his face and into his beard. They were fairly high up here, albeit not exactly in the Andes foothills, just in the high Amazon basin. It was cool at night. It wasn't the temperature that made him sweat. He glanced at the others, just visible in the light scatter of moonlight from the window. Hayes, crouched like a badger, scowled furiously with his jaw clamped on his unlit cigar. Sean Reichert squatted, bouncing slightly on his heels, visibly struggling to contain his nervous energy. Only Joe Weaver looked impassive, sitting by the wall with his knees drawn up and his thick forearms crossed over them, his craggy, bearded face as immobile as a gold statue of the Buddha behind the circular glasses. From the volume of firing, Robeson guessed Consuelo's people, whom he and the others had taken to thinking of and referring to in their sub-vocalized conversations as guerrillas, had pulled out at the first sign of attack. He took for granted that most of the gunfire was simply caps being busted for effect, mostly to make the shooter seem valiant or to reassure him, and that few bullets strayed close to their intended targets, if any. He'd experienced third-world firefights before.
Stand easy, just be cool.
Reichert smiled a tight smile and nodded. A shadow crossed the door. To no one's particular surprise, it was another figure incorporating an AK-47 silhouette. There was a flare of yellow light, and a bearded face stared into the hut in underlit surprise. Then he turned to face outside and waved his arms to get someone's attention.
Hey! Gringos!
Vivo!
Si!
Muy pronto nos encargaremos de eso!
Sounds like we got a guy with an itchy trigger finger heading our way.
A bandy-legged man in a beret and a bulky jungle camouflage jacket stepped up beside the first man. He jacked the slide on a .45 caliber Colt Model 1911 handgun. Hayes held up his hands, displaying empty palms.
We come in peace. Paz. Vamos en son de paz.
The pistolero was clean-shaven and wore shades, despite the fact the string and penumbra of an eye patch was clearly visible around the right lens. He grinned and raised the big handgun.
Paren!
The order in Spanish to halt came from outside the door. For a moment more, the one-eyed man in the sunglasses held down on Larry Robeson. Even in the darkness, the fat bore of the .45 seemed an infinite tunnel into infinite blackness. With reluctance visible even in the dim illumination, the gunman lowered his piece. He stepped back away from the doorway.
Por favor, salga. Despacio, porque no queremos que mis hombres se pongan nerviosos.
The teammates looked at one another.
Did I just hear that guy outside politely ask us to step out slowly?
That's what the man said.
A tall man on a white horse awaited them. His lengthy sideburns framed a long face, and he had curly dark hair and lots of white teeth showing as he smiled.
I am Simon the Liberator. Welcome, my friends.
So far, so good.
That's what worries me.
Men are always looking for things to worry about.
Bridget looked cool, professional, and in command as they walked down the beta-level corridor. She was dressed once again in the crisp garments of a senior archivist. Like Kane, she had hurriedly scrubbed off the skin tone from face, neck, and arms in the stairwell, but her eyes were still brown and her hair the same brassy hue. They reckoned that her total appearance was different enough that leaving her with hair a red, wildly different from her natural shade, would scarcely increase her risk of exposure. Besides, having two magistrates, huge, in gleaming black hard-contact armor and helmets, walking right behind her guaranteed no one looked too closely at her. Which was vital, since sooner or later an unfamiliar face would be spotted, even if a familiar one wasn't. The presence of a pair of hard-contact magistrates would certainly discourage anyone from indulging idle curiosity. Mags tended to think of themselves as the ones who asked all the questions. And when things failed to match their expectations, they had some pretty brisk methods for getting reality to line up right in their eyes. Of course, there was always the risk a trained archivist's eye for detail would still pick up something that might unravel the whole scam, despite the tendency of everybody's eyes to slide away from Mags, especially faceless in full armor with slightly concave red visors on their helmets. It was just a risk they took. They had all been bashed about far too much by reality to imagine anything happened without risk, least of all penetrating the heart of an enemy stronghold, where they had all once, not too long ago, been very well known indeed. They moved through a seldom-traveled area within the Great White Monolith. Lakesh had provided them with counterfeit identichips that would grant them access to where they needed to go, to a special sensitive data storage area whose workstations were not connected to any outside network, which was still the only real guarantee they couldn't be cracked and siphoned from without. The one thing you could say, Kane reflected, was that they had worked so far.
I'd always been taught it was women who were the worriers.
Like Grant, Kane had packed the whole body armor suit into a mock shabby rucksack. The armor was bulky but not heavy, and the pieces could be nestled inside one another to reduce the space they took up. Fortunately, transportation was at a premium in the Outlands, and even when roamers such as the three impersonated had access to wags, the areas they were allowed to enter within the city were severely restricted. Traders from the Outlands, staggering beneath the weight of overstuffed, monumentally heavy packs, were a common sight in the Tartarus pits.
Another typical example of the male chauvinist indoctrination you received growing up in the Magistrate Division.
Agreed. So I suppose your anti-masculine bias is all natural? Or did they teach you that in little archivist day school?
By no means. I mean, what anti-masculine bias?
Get a room. This isn't the time or the place.
Bridget favored him with an extra ferocious glare. Kane stopped and swiveled his head to look up and down the corridor.
Grant's not the only one worrying. I can hardly believe this is going to work. It can't be this easy.
Bridget ran her chip past the sensor. The door slid open. Grant looked at Kane, who shrugged.
Okay, maybe it can be that easy.
A woman started to step forth from the secured terminal chamber. She froze at the sight of the sinister figures looming before her.
Oh, I'm sorry. Please, I didn't know you were here.
Go about your business, archivist.
The woman, small, stooped, and mousy, was of indeterminate age. All archivists Kane had ever seen looked middle-aged, to him anyway, except Baptiste. The archivist started to move past. Then she stopped and stared searchingly at the dark face of the taller woman in senior archivist garb.
Wait, you're not... Bridget? You're Bridget Baptiste, the renegade!
She turned and darted back inside the room.
Alicia, wait!
Although the joints of his polycarbonate armor constricted his limbs, Kane glided into the room like a snake. His right hand rose to his ear and snapped forward. Something flickered in the air. The fleeing Alicia slammed face first into the wall angled to the one against which the secured console rested. She reached a pale hand, bones and tendons starting out from the skin, toward an alarm button on the wall. Kane straightened his arm toward her. His Sin Eater leaped from its holster and slammed into his hand, aimed at her back.
Alicia! Did you have to do that, Kane?
Kane looked at her with eyes that would have been unreadable even had the scarcely translucent visor not hidden them from her.
Yeah, he did. Now shut the door before somebody else stumbles onto us. We have to kill more noisily.
The Sin Eater snapped back into its forearm holster. With a last scowl at him, but no further sign of emotion, Bridget swept forward and sat down at the terminal, putting on a pair of heavy-framed eyeglasses as she did. She did not glance at the body of her acquaintance, now cooling to ambient temperature. The things they had seen and done and suffered since fleeing Cobaltville together with Domi a few years before had hardened even Kane and Grant, who would have sworn beforehand that all softness had been crushed from them by their hard years as mags. That much more had life in exile hardened Bridget, who, granted, had had farther to go. The fact was, though, that now she scarcely turned a hair at things that would have made her male companions blanch in their magistrate days. Grant and Kane shed their own packs. Unusual as well, but only a mag would dare question another mag. Cain pulled off a gauntlet and went to check the sad huddle of blood-stained clothes by the wall. The woman's neck was already clammy to the touch, stuck slightly to his fingertip like chicken skin. He felt no pulse.
Chilled, sure.
Bridget didn't so much as glance his way. Nonetheless, he saw her tense in the muscles of her neck and shoulders.
I knew her way too well, and vice versa.
What? You wouldn't want her to suffer, would you?
You're a bastard, Cain.
And then some. But a breathing bastard.
Very well. I know what I need. I found the references.
She swiveled the chair right and pointed to a locked cabinet of white enameled metal.
In there. But we don't have the access key for that.
I do. Fire in the hole.
Thank you.
Bridget knelt briefly, swung a hinged rack of CDs out, examined their serial numbers briefly, then stood with an iridescent plastic disc clasped between thumb and forefinger and went back to the workstation.
Now we see if what we want even exists.
There's a cheerful thought that we got all the way in here for nothing.
Bridget ignored him. The room was bare and tiny. Grant paced it. It took him about a step and a half each way with his long, muscle-corded legs.
You used to be the calm one.
I used to belong in this goddamn armor with this goddamn badge on, too. Who'd have ever thought it would happen? I was the ultimate mag. Now all this shit gives me the creeps.
Oh, I set it off. There's a software watch on the information we're looking for that calls for help even if a user with baronial-class access tries to retrieve it, as I just did.
I know that, Baptiste. Wait. Does that mean you don't fucking have it?
Not at all. It's right here.
Then we're not about to die for nothing?
If you're trying to take up looking on the bright side, don't. You don't have a knack for it.
He raised his hand. His sin-eater slammed into it.
Then again, I'm not exactly ready to die quite yet myself.
Wait until the hard contact ready squad gets here.
He looked to Bridget, who was standing up from the console. She had ejected the CD from the drive and was slipping it into the pocket of her smock.
So that's it? No holograms, no rotating 3D representations, not even a trumpet fanfare?
Saskatchewan.
Gesundheit.
That's our objective. The Totality Concept built an ultra-secret underground redoubt in Saskatchewan, in what was Canada, an area notorious for high levels of crop circle activity, right before the nuke cost.
Open up in there!
Grant Sin-Eater came out.
And now, how the hell do we get out of here?